Welcome back. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara. And so, as we told you earlier in the show, we have here on studio and then on the phone, we have Daniel Kim, and here in studio we have Mark Anthony Johnson, who were both members of a four-people delegation that went to Miami-Dade County to do voter protection work out in Miami, and were there for about, Mark Anthony was there about 2 weeks, and Daniel was there for about a week, roughly, and they were there to sort of do the postpartum party that Bush had won by so many votes in Miami, and Florida, by such a large amount that was just, you know, crazy and still unbelievable at this moment. So welcome to the show, Mark Anthony and Daniel.
How you doing?
Let me start with Mark Anthony. Mark Anthony Johnson is, just to give you guys an intro, Mark Anthony Johnson is an organizer in training at the National School for Strategic Organizing at the Strategy Center, and has been a member of the Planning Committee of the Bus Riders Union for the last year. And the brother is a very young age of 20 years old, and had this great opportunity to go out there and join Damon and other folks down there to do voter protection. Mark Anthony, why don't you describe to us, you know, what sort of led for you to go out to Miami and do the, you know, decided to do voter protection work out there?
Right. Well, I mean, basically, the way I was walking up to the elections, I guess, the couple weeks leading up to the election, I was thinking about, you know, 2000 and just how much that was a blatant and overt example of how we as black people in the U.S. Weren't meant to have full rights. I mean, at any given time, this system relies on our disenfranchisement, and in its most aggressive moments functions off our genocide, and that's all oppressed people. But particularly with 2000, I think it was just a blatant example of how our rights aren't full and how they never will be. And so when the opportunity came up to go to Florida, I mean, it was, one, it was an opportunity to go check out and see, like, okay, how are black folks feeling out there in Florida, particularly it being the South and, you know, just the land where just the home of slavery and, you know, just to check out and see how people are really feeling about it, you know, the scene of the crime, you know, what type of movement has been going on out there. And, you know, we went to the Miami Workers Center, and they broke it down for us. They were like, I mean, look, there's been really no long-term organizing going on in the past 4 years. And that in itself was just really disheartening. And even more so because, like, you had more middle forces like the NAACP had start doing get-out-the-vote work. Starting like July, August. And while that's really important work, really amazing work, right? Being that, I mean, black folks turned out in record numbers for this election, registered across the country in record numbers for this election. But, I mean, all we did was vote. And there was very little criticism of Kerry, very little criticism of the Democratic Party. You know, we go out on the bus and folks are still talking about we need Clinton in office. And so while that is very important work, I think it was very disheartening to see that, one, there was very little long-term organizing work. And then, two, that our anti-racist, anti-Bush energy was being folded under into this get-out-the-vote campaign across the country.
You know, I've been reading a lot of sort of dispatches and news and been listening to KPFK also the last couple of weeks since the elections, and a lot of people who were out there doing voter protection work here or getting the vote out or getting out the vote in New Mexico or Nevada, a lot of people have the sense that, you know, there was a certain energy that was just really huge in the sense that a lot of people really felt that this was like the work that SNCC at one moment was doing back in the 60s, right. work that CORE was doing back in the days, or the Southern Christian Leadership Council. I'll ask both of you. Let's start with Daniel. Daniel, did you get that sense? I mean, did you feel like, hey, this could be the beginning of a new civil rights movement where people are defending the right of a person to a right to vote, which was won technically, you know, 39 years ago. Did it have that air of, hey, man, I'm doing something here historical, trying to defend a right that has taken so many years to even get?
Yeah. Well, I might just say to start as well in terms of why I went down. I mean, I live in Boulder, Colorado, Denver, Colorado right now. And I was looking at doing whatever I could to try to defeat Bush. And my options were looking like, having to work with, a Democratic Party precinct captain and just to get out the vote work and door knocking and whatnot. When I heard that there was an opportunity to go down to Florida, you know, in the scene of the crime in 2000, and to actually work to defeat Bush with anti-racist, anti-imperialist left politics, I just jumped at it. And then being down there, I guess, you know, beginning of a movement would be a good way to say it because, we were about 25 people, about 8 or 10 sort of local to Miami and Florida, and then a couple of people from New York and a few people from the Bay Area, and the four of us from L.A. And to put it in perspective, I was just remembering, I think Freedom Summer in 1964, the estimate was something like 70,000 people had come down to the South to register black voters. And here we were with 25 people.
Well, they had 70,000 lawyers, didn't they?
But at the same time, I still would say that, I felt like it was the beginning of a movement because, for one historical imperative, in 1964, they had always talked about that it was only about 6 to 7% of African Americans that were registered to vote in Mississippi. And one of the things that we took out to the streets in Miami was that, one in three African American votes had been thrown out in 2000. And that there was clearly sort of, part of this history of disenfranchisement and sort of repression of the will of a people. So there was that aspect. But in terms of the beginning of a movement and building one, even with 25 people, when we first got down there, Damon told me that, Election Protection Coalition and Voices for Working Families and some of these other sort of mainstream civil rights and labor organizations that have mobilized volunteers from around the country, that in Florida alone they had something like 16,000 people. And if we had 25 people, what kind of role were we going to play? And at the same time, we ended up playing a very important role. We ended up breaking open Miami-Dade County to get international observers to come in from Haiti, Mexico, Nicaragua, and other countries. And then we were actually able to be sort of tactical leadership on the ground on election day, where we actually sort of, were the front lines of defending the black vote.
Actually, Daniel, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because here, people who didn't necessarily do election protection work, I think that in terms of your team, it was Daniel, and then you had Larry from Power, people organized to win employment rights in the Bay Area working as a team. Maybe if you can just kind of run through November 2nd, an election day, and what you guys did from 5:30 in the morning to like 11:30 at night.
Right. Well, maybe I can start by painting a picture of what the precincts looked like. Basically, okay. The 25 of us, we had a headquarters that was like communications and intelligence central that had connections that hook up to media and that could mobilize the international observers to get to any hot spots. And then we had sort of six teams, and me and Larry were one team. We were six mobile teams. We basically had a car, and we were assigned 10 precincts. So with six teams, 10 precincts, each precinct with about 1,000 registered voters in it, you were looking at, protecting basically 60,000 black votes in Miami-Dade County. And what we did was we would roll around to the precincts that we were covering And at a typical precinct, you'd have, I mean, they'd be, I imagine, a lot like LA, like schools, churches, retirement home lobbies. And in front of them, you would have these, some of these 16,000 volunteers who'd come in from around the country, as well as local people who've been hired by these organizations to be monitors. You'd have people for Voices for Working Families. You'd have people in black shirts from the Election Protection Coalition. And then you'd have carry lawyers out front. And we quickly had to figure out that a loop of trying to do 10 precincts would probably take about 3 to 4 hours. So Larry and I sort of, you know, being good organizers and trained organizers, we sort of adapted on the fly. And what we did was, since we knew that there were going to be these sort of mainstream civil rights organization volunteers there all day, that they could be our ears and eyes, and we would sort of play like a kind of a tactical lead role. So we would kind of build relationships with the people who were sitting there, you know, in their lawn chairs, and monitoring the state, the precinct. But we would also sort of galvanize them. One kind of key thing that emerged was that these people who had been, who were volunteers and doing monitoring, they had a, I mean, to give you an example, their T-shirts, the Election Protection Coalition T-shirt, just had text on it, and it said, if you've had any problems voting, come and talk to us. And it had a phone number and whatnot. And it basically said legal aid. And Voices for Working Families, would, they just had clipboards, and they sort of sat in chairs and watched people coming out and made sure there weren't any problems. And our T-shirt said, take back the vote. And it had, you know, a few people on the front of it basically with their fists in the air. And what we did was basically to provide, you know, a militant kind of spirit and to galvanize people to really feeling like, you know, we were a team that was defending the vote, that was turning back the tide from 2000. I mean, we would roll up to a precinct and start talking with some of these poll monitor volunteers, and they wouldn't even have a picture of, you know, what the Republican strategy was probably going to be in terms of voter challenges or forcing people on the provisional ballot. And I would say, you know, well, I guess you've heard about the Republican strategy with the, you know, challenging voters inside. They would say no. So we would fill them in and sort of, it would be like briefing them and sort of bringing them up to speed and saying, you know, we're part of this team that is going to fight, that's going to fight back. And people would sort of get into it. They would take down their cell phone numbers, and as we would be rolling around different precincts, they would call us. They wouldn't call their own, their own organization. They would call us, and they would ask, you know, they would say, well, hey, you know, there's this guy here, he says he's an ex-felon, he got reinstated, but they're turning him down, what can we do? And so we would sort of, we knew that there was an NAACP lawyer over at another precinct, we would call him, you know, get him over to this church where this guy was, and then work from there. And people really, I mean, even the carry lawyers, we would call them and sort of, they would update to us like they were updating, you know, to, I mean, we were like an army, basically, and that we were sort of soldiers defending the black vote. So I just, I mean, in awe, we really felt so strong out there. I mean, we really kind of wished that the Republicans had fought harder. They actually didn't end up fighting that hard, and no doubt because we were such a strong presence out there that they knew. I mean, we had a couple of instances where a Republican lawyer inside would have sort of a bogus ex-felons list, and we would find out and then sort of bring in international observers, international monitors, and the Republican would deny that he had any kind of list like that, and then he would back off, and nothing. In all of the 70 precincts, 60 precincts that we were covering, you know, we had just two or three sort of place Republican lawyers inside precincts who tried to implement their challenge of their strategy of challenging voters and whatnot as illegitimate. So, you know, we came back after a long day, and you know, started watching the returns coming in, and you know, we were hit pretty hard by you know, when Florida was called for Bush, but
let's go into Mark Anthony, can you do, I mean, I have sort of a two-piece question for you. One is, you should definitely tell us, you know, just quickly what you did out there. You know, what kind of work did you do? Did you do organizing? Did you do voter protection? But secondly, I think the more important question I have for you is that, you know, last week in particular, I remember people calling into KPFK, and there were still people saying kind of confused, like, I don't know who I want to vote for. We live in a dictatorship, and I don't see the point of voting. And yet, you know, here you are, I think still a Pierce Community College student, and, some of the stuff you're saying are really deep, brother. I mean, you're talking about how the right to vote, just for everybody to give us a call down or send us an email down at info@busridersunion.org, and we can send you a dispatch that Mark Anthony wrote up from Miami, where he essentially was saying, hey, you know, for black people who have essentially been oppressed by this system, the very act of voting and the very act of protecting that right to vote is self-determination. And I think it's just really refreshing for any folks right now in this moment in history to sort of look at how powerful that is, because I think we are in a place right now, or we're in a place in the movement where, you know, they elevate tactics like direct action, building autonomous organizations, which are all important, and that's what, you know, particularly me and a lot of people in this room have dedicated themselves to doing, but still don't, you know, sort of say, hey, you know, getting into the electoral system is a slippery slope, it's a nasty thing, both parties, you know, represent the same thing, why should we even take people, fool them to even join and vote for, you know, the lesser of two evils. So I want you to, you know, sort of explore what your dispatch kind of said about why you thought it was such an important, and why, even though you're not voting for self-determination, as Damon said earlier, it is a fight for self-determination at the same time.
Right. Definitely I feel like just the history that we've had in this country fighting for the right to vote has had a really radical context to it. And I do feel still that it is a very radical thing to do. And just looking at, from slavery to prisons, which is just an extension of slavery, to schools, which just prepares us to get locked up, we were never meant to have full rights. And so I feel like us winning these rights, particularly in a country that does not want us here, that is pretty clear that they don't want us here, is an amazing victory that has to be protected. It has to be taken advantage of, and more tactically than anything. To just go out and vote, yes, that's one way to make your voice heard, but it's, unfortunately, I feel like, you know, you go out on the bus, we organize, and a lot of folks, the sense of disillusionment and the sense of disempowerment comes with feeling like the vote is the only way to make our voices heard. Mm-hmm. And so if we can, one, look at the vote and start to move beyond that and look at the vote as just one tactical move, backed by a movement, backed by some grounded analysis of what is a vote going to do for us? How is it going to improve our conditions here, improve conditions for people in the third world, improve conditions for people throughout the diaspora? I mean, for me, it's still a very, very radical decision to make, as long as it gets beyond just voting, because that I do see that as self-defeating. Which is part of that disheartenment that I talked about, the fact that there was so much anger, so much disappointment, so much feeling around the fact that Bush, all this anti-Bush energy was folded into these get-out-to-vote campaigns. And it was just so much to see what us as 25 organizers could do on the ground, and the fact that you had so many different forces pulling thousands of cats out to Florida. To me, there has to be a shift. We have to start moving beyond that.
So, Mark Anthony, I know since you wrote the dispatch, which everybody's going to email and get out the Oral Wild, this is the alternative media. I know after you wrote that, you went out to the Pork and Bean Projects in Miami-Dade County to talk to poor black folks about what they were thinking. So maybe you can share some of those thoughts with us.
Right, right. So we rolled out to, actually, it wasn't the Pork and Beans. The Pork and Beans was actually, it's like a government-owned project. We went out to this Section 8 project, which is privately owned. And so there's different risks around gentrification. But we went out, talked to folks, and, you know, try to get a sense of what people are feeling. And it's pretty, it's the same heaviness, you know. I was talking to this one woman. She had been here since the 1970s. She was a domestic worker. I've been here since the 1970s, immigrant, and she was just saying, like, I don't know what to do. Like, if Bush is in office, like, I mean, they're killing now, they're stealing now, but people are going to have to kill more. People are going to have to steal more just to survive. And, I mean, that's, like, people understood that, and people knew, like, people saw in the morning, people turned out to vote. Black folks turned out to vote, and the community was aware of that. And so to see Bush win was like, everybody was like, what happened? Like, what's going on? And I think it's, for me, it was even more evident how much that has to be transformed into getting beyond the electoral process is just a vote. But yeah, I mean, people, yeah, same thing. There's definitely a heaviness to it. People know what reality is coming, so.
Daniel, just to get back to you, I mean, just also to, you know, let you sort of chime in on this question, which I think is becoming more and more clear for me, at least, you know, as we've been doing this work of, you know, doing voter education and voter registration on the bus, and your trip to Miami has clarified, and, you know, obviously the book that Eric Mann wrote called The Elections 2004, Turning Point for the Left, where this concept that the Democratic right to vote, given in these really reactionary times, and given that most people in this country, but particularly oppressed people, particularly blacks and Chicanos and Asians and American indigenous people, just like I remember last week, they were saying how in South Dakota, the people were not going to be harassed at the polling place, and also that the Republicans could not write their driver's plates down. I guess they were, you know, they're writing down their plates, I don't know, to either go scare them or just go talk to them later on. I mean, what do you think about this concept that, you know, on some level, given such a reactionary country that we live in, and that, you know, people have been denied throughout history their right to vote, that in many ways it's revolutionary to, you know, protect the right to vote and to actually bear the right to even, you know, put down your vote for someone or a proposition.
Yeah. I would actually agree with that the democratic right to vote and to have the votes counted. And the reform, actually, of the Electoral College would be, you know, revolutionary demands that entire, you know, national campaigns could be built around. And, you know, in terms of specifically self-determination, you know, and the liberation of black people, there's sort of three things that are things that I experienced down there doing the work on November 2nd that really sort of spoke to me that way. The first was that as we rolled around to the different precincts, we would meet, you know, these local people who had been hired by the national organizations to sit and watch the polls. And I rolled up to one place, and there was this elderly black Southern woman sitting in a lawn chair. She had a cooler beside her, and she had a young sort of companion, might have been a relative, with her. And I approached her, and I gave her, you know, I had developed a rap that I sort of, you know, would use to introduce myself, and she just sort of looked at me through the whole thing. And by the end of it, I sort of said, well, you know, is everything all right here? You know, these are the things that we can do. She said, everything's going to be fine here. This is my neighborhood. and I'm watching this poll, and, you know, you might need to go over, you know, over there to that neighborhood. Over here, nothing's going to happen because I know my neighborhood, and my neighborhood is going to be fine. And I said, I'm sorry, your name is, she said, you introduced yourself, but I did not introduce myself. But if you want to know, my name is Miss Beulah Johnson. And she just so clearly communicated to me that, you know, this was not just her neighborhood, but this was her land, right? I mean, she'd lived here for, I mean, she was 70 years old or so. And there was that historical connection to place. And, you know, another place I went to was a very small Baptist church, and folks were just sitting around, like, having a party around the church. And as everybody came in to vote, they would know them by name, and they would make jokes about, you know, you better make sure you press that red button when you get in there, because some people are forgetting. They would, you know, when they would come out, they would, you know, sit down for a little while and talk. So this was like, it really brought home to me that these were people's homes, and the land that basically belonged to them. The last thing was just that, you know, we would also, at the end of the day, we all went into specific polling stations and watched the polls close, which means we watched them take down the computers, you know, tally all the votes, and then print out the actual vote count. You know, in the place where we were, it was like 501 votes for Kerry, 11 for Bush, and then 8 for third-party candidates, and another 5 people didn't vote for president. But that was like, you know, 500 to, you know, 20-some-odd, you know, votes. So it's basically, if there's this unanimous voice of a people, and then it's repeating itself in all the black counties of all the black southern states, you know, how could it be that, you know, the unanimous voice of a people doesn't add up to one single electoral college vote? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the core of what would be, you know, the revolutionary character of you know, the demand for the right for black votes to count, is that they would speak to sort of, you know, self-determination, to sort of the peoplehood of African Americans inside the United States, that they are a historically constituted people, and they have sort of a national voice, if you will, and the fight to actually have it mean something significant in government would be a radical sort of demand in a campaign that would challenge the system to its roots.
Well, you've been listening to Daniel Kim and Mark Anthony Johnson. Daniel is in Denver, Colorado, and Mark Anthony is here on live here on down at the studios here at KPFK with us. I'd like to thank both of these gentlemen. I think they've been great. Again, you know, if you're interested in getting Mark Anthony's dispatch, that he, you know, it's an excellent dispatch, please, you know, send us a email at info@busridersunion.org or info@thestrategycenter.org, and we'll be happy to send you. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us, and we'll be right back.